We are in the Gospel of Mark, and we are continuing our tour through the book, and we have made it now to chapter 14. And as we've been talking about, we are in the third and final phase of the book of Mark, where Jesus has made it to Jerusalem, and now he is preparing to accomplish what his purpose has been all along. And once he has arrived in Jerusalem, he's just sort of been dealing with opposition nonstop. His enemies have been peppering him with questions, and he's been responding elegantly and beautifully and wisely. And with each response, he also goes on to teach profound truths. And so even though the people's questions didn't have the right motivation, I'm glad that they asked them, because we have some really beautiful teaching from Jesus in response. But Jesus goes on to ask some of his own questions. He asked them about the baptism of John. Was that from heaven or from men? He asked them about Psalm 110, where David wrote, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool." And as he asked questions, trying to help them see who he was, they just really had no answer. They had no response. Jesus told a parable about a man that had a vineyard, and he sent his servants to go and to claim some of the produce of the vineyard, and they were put to death. And finally he sent his son, and they put the son to death as well. And Jesus tells that parable very clearly, picturing the chief priests and the scribes and the elders there. And we just finished chapter 13, where Jesus is leaving the temple, and he has been observing some of the terrible ways that the Jews in power have really taken the heart out of the worship and made it into something selfish and worldly. And his disciples say, "Man, Jesus, these buildings are pretty spectacular." And Jesus, heartbroken, I'm sure, realizes that they're making the same mistake that the Jews have been making in the temple. That the scribes and the Pharisees and the chief priests, they're thinking about physical things and selfish ways. And Jesus teaches his disciples that those buildings are not going to last. And as we talked about the Olivet Discourse, as Jesus predicts the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, he also says some things that are very helpful for us as we think about the final judgment of this world. And although it's sort of difficult at some points to say, is he talking about the fall of Jerusalem at this point or the end of the world at this point, the message is essentially the same. He told his disciples, if you get too attached to this city, you will perish along with it. And we finished last week talking about the fact that if we love the world or the things in the world, that we will be destroyed along with it. And it's those who love the Lord that endure forever. And so with all of that being said, we see that time is actually advancing. And we're getting closer and closer to the end of this story. And Mark 14, verses 1 and 2 give us a time marker. It says, "It was now 2 days before the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to arrest him by stealth and kill him. For they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar from the people." So Mark tells us that it's now 2 days before the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And this is going to be the backdrop, really, for the rest of the book, the events surrounding these feast days in Jerusalem. Passover would begin at sundown on Thursday. So keep in mind that the Jews started their days at sundown. And so 2 sundowns away would be Passover, which means that the events that we're reading about in this chapter would have happened on Wednesday. The Feast of Unleavened Bread would be a feast that would immediately follow the Passover. And it would be a 7-day feast, a 7-day festival where they would eat unleavened bread. And so what we're being told is that this is the Wednesday before all of that would start on Thursday. Now, notice that Jesus' enemies have changed their tactics at this point. If you go back and look at chapter 12, in chapter 12 and verse 12, it says there that they were seeking to arrest him after that parable of the tenants, but feared the people, for they perceived that he had told the parable against them. So they left him and went away. So way back in chapter 12, they were seeking to arrest him, and they feared the people. But by the time we get to chapter 14, they're not only seeking to arrest him, but they're seeking how to assassinate him, essentially. They still fear the people. They don't want to cause an uproar. Jesus is pretty popular among the general audience. but those who are in authority are trying to get rid of him. And so what they decide is, you know, they haven't been able to trap him in his talk, so let's just physically trap him and physically kill him, but let's wait till after Jerusalem thins out. Once all these people that have come to the city for these feasts go home, then we'll have a better opportunity to get rid of Jesus. And now what we see next is a story within a story. Mark does this several times where he begins to tell us one thing and then tells us about a different thing and then comes back to that first thing. And that's what happens next in verses 3 through 9. So in verse 3, "And while he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at table, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard, very costly. And she broke the flask and poured it over his head. There were some who said to themselves indignantly, 'Why was the ointment wasted like that? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor.' And they scolded her. But Jesus said, 'Leave her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, and whenever you want, you can do good for them, but you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for burial. And truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her." Now, you don't realize this as you're reading Mark 14, but this story is actually a flashback. And the way that we know that is because John 12 tells us pretty explicitly. John 12 tells us that this actually happened 6 days before the Passover, which would have put this on the Saturday before the triumphal entry. And John 12 also gives us another interesting detail, that this unnamed woman is actually Mary, the sister of Lazarus and Martha. And so when we're told here that they're in the home of Simon the leper in Bethany, we find out that apparently Simon the leper also lived with Lazarus and Mary and Martha. But Matthew and Mark both choose to record this story right here, right after this section about it being 2 days before the Passover and the chief priests and scribes seeking to arrest Jesus. They place the story right here, and I think it's for a purpose. There's some good thematic reasons for that. And I think as we continue to unfold this chapter, we'll be able to see those things. But I want you to see what Mary does. In verse 3, Mary comes up to Jesus while he's reclining at table, and she has this alabaster flask of expensive ointment. Later, when she's criticized for it down in verse 5, we find out that this ointment was worth 300 denarii. Now, if you start to do the math on that, and you realize that a denarius is a day's wage, 300 days' wages is a lot of money. I mean, we're talking about something that's worth thousands and thousands of dollars, essentially a year's salary, you know, if you take weekends off. And so she breaks this ointment. She doesn't just drip a few drops, but she breaks the ointment and she pours it all out on Jesus' head. Some people have looked at this story and proposed the idea that maybe this alabaster flask of ointment was like a family heirloom. You know, something that was that valuable is not something that anybody would generally use in their lifetime. It would just be a few drops here and there for special occasions, and you might pass it on down to your children. And so what Mary does is extreme. I mean, it is amazing. She doesn't just pour a few drops on Jesus, and she doesn't just, you know, liberally sprinkle half the bottle. She breaks it and completely pours it out. And with all that being said, you can understand why people are shocked in verses 4 and 5. You know, you've got people that are saying, why did she do this? That we could have sold this and the money could have been given to the poor, and they scold her there in verse 5. The disciples are so shocked at what she's done that they're upset about it. It really bothers them. Another interesting detail from John chapter 12 is that John actually tells us who the chief critic was of Mary, and it was Judas. Judas is the one that spoke up and said, hey, we could have sold this and given the money to the poor. And then John actually goes on to tell us in parentheses, John didn't actually care about the poor, or Judas didn't actually care about the poor. He actually kept the money box, and he liked to help himself to that money sometimes. But what Mary does is so extreme and so amazing that it really bothers the people that are in the room, and they react very strongly to it. And Jesus responds. In verse 7, Jesus basically says, you know, if you're really concerned about the poor, you're going to have plenty of opportunities to take care of the poor. But then look at what he says about what she has done. In verse 6, Jesus says, she has done a beautiful thing to me. In verse 8, he says, she has anointed my body beforehand for burial. You see, what Jesus points out to his disciples is that what you're not realizing is that this is totally appropriate based on who I am. This is totally fitting. What she has done is not anything excessive. What she's done is not anything that's over the top. What she's done is the most appropriate thing that anybody could do if they were to recognize who I am. In fact, Mary is recognizing the value of Jesus even more than the rest of the people in the room, even more than his disciples. And what's amazing is that Jesus adds this detail in verse 9. He says, truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her. And the amazing thing about that is we are fulfilling that prophecy right now. You know that? 2,000 years later, on the opposite side of the globe, we're a group of people sitting around talking about Jesus, talking about the gospel, and we're talking about Mary, who anointed his head with oil. I think that's amazing. And even this prophecy, if you want to call it that, these words of Jesus are ringing true as we talk about Mary's example. So let's spend just a moment talking about why Mary is such a good example. We've already hit on a couple of these things. But one thing you might think about is that Mary recognized the value of Jesus. She knew that whatever she gave to Jesus, whatever she sacrificed in order to honor him, it wouldn't be a waste. You know, there's really no limit to how much you can give Jesus before you've given too much. That line just doesn't exist. Mary knew that. Secondly, Mary is a good example because she gave without holding back. You know, if it was me and I had this, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars worth of ointment, it'd be tempting to say, Jesus, I'll give you 2 drops, not just one, you know. But Mary breaks the bottle. She pours it out over Jesus' head. She has no intentions of saving any of it for herself. And she shows us a really good attitude because she wasn't asking, you know, what's the minimum amount that I should give in order to honor Jesus? You know, it wasn't like she got out her tip calculator and she was like, okay, can I get away with 15% or do I need to do 20%? You know, like, she wasn't doing that math. She wasn't asking the questions about, like, how much do I need to sacrifice for Jesus so that he'll be pleased with me? She was just happy to sacrifice for Jesus. She was happy to give what she had. She was eager to give without holding back. But then thirdly, the other thing that I see about her is that Mary was unashamed of her devotion. You know, she could have waited until a more private opportunity to do this for Jesus. You know, she could have kind of read the room and seen the people there and like took an eye at Judas and said, I'm going to wait for these people to clear out. I know they're not going to really be supportive of what I'm about to do. I'll just do this in private. And that's not what she did. She knew that it was the right thing to do. She wanted to do it. And so she did it without any sense of shame or embarrassment. You know what's really interesting is that the world tends to celebrate people who are fanatical for worldly things, but tends to scoff at people who are fanatical for spiritual things. You know, somebody that gets up early and works hard at their job and really just grinds out the day and, you know, hustles and makes a living, that's somebody that the world says, what a great example of work ethic and determination. And that person has some good qualities, no doubt. Or, you know, the Olympic athlete who never takes a day off and watches every bite of what he eats and trains every single day for hours on end, that's somebody that the world says, that is spectacular, that's amazing. But somebody who's really dedicated to Jesus, gives their life, gives their time, sacrifices things in order to follow him, the world looks at that person and says, that person's kind of nuts, you know? That person needs to sort of dial it back. They're kind of being a little bit obsessive about their religion. And I think sometimes that makes us a little bit afraid to be as all in as we should be in following Jesus. Maybe sometimes we feel embarrassed. And I like to think about David in 2 Samuel 6. In 2 Samuel 6, David brought the ark into the city of Jerusalem, and his wife criticized him for the way that he celebrated. And in 2 Samuel 6, verse 21, David said, I will celebrate before the Lord. I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in your eyes. You know, I know that there's a couple of different ways to read what David did there, but I think David is really demonstrating the same kind of attitude that Mary is demonstrating here. That I'm going to give to the Lord the best that I have. I'm going to give all that I have. I'm not going to think about what other people think about that. I'm not going to be ashamed of it. If people think that I'm a little bit too excited or a little bit too committed, so be it. There's no shame in giving the Lord enthusiastic devotion. Mary is a great example of that. Well, after this story, this is the other bookend of the story within a story. So remember in chapter 14, it begins in verses 1 and 2, telling us that the chief priests and the scribes and the elders, they wanted to arrest Jesus and kill him, but they decided they would wait till after the feast. And then we have the story about Mary anointing Jesus' head with this costly ointment. But now, when we get to verse 10, it tells us, then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. And he sought an opportunity to betray him. So this is the outer frame of that story within a story. Do you see why Mark inserted the story about Mary where he did? Even though it's not truly chronological, Judas and Mary are exact opposites of one another. Mary was willing to sacrifice her expensive ointment to honor Jesus, while Judas was willing to betray Jesus for money. And this is only 4 days later. 4 days since Judas himself was critical of the way that Mary sacrificed her ointment to honor Jesus, Judas goes and betrays Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. Now, remember that the scribes and the chief priests and the elders are fearful of the people. They don't want to cause an uproar while everybody's in Jerusalem. And so I think that this changes their plans. They were wanting to wait till everybody left, but Judas comes to them with an offer that they can't refuse. And Judas says, you know, I could tell you where he is when the people are away. And so they're happy. They say, wow, what a great opportunity. They're willing to offer him money to get that information so they don't have to wait till after the feast is over. It's Matthew 26 and verse 15 that tells us that they offered him 30 pieces of silver. But the thing that's interesting about that is that that is worth much less than Mary's ointment was. Most people think that the 30 pieces of silver were actually just 30 ordinary Roman denarii. And isn't that interesting? That Mary was willing to sacrifice 300 denarii worth of ointment, and Judas is willing to betray Jesus for 30 denarii. Mary was willing to waste 10 times as much to honor Jesus as Judas was willing to betray him for. I think that's a pretty profound thing to notice. There's all kinds of reasons why people have posited for why Judas betrayed Jesus, and some of them are pretty outlandish. There are some people who think that Judas didn't really think that it was possible that Jesus could be arrested. I mean, he's eluded authorities in the past. Why wouldn't he elude the authorities now? And so if I can make a quick buck and they look silly, then, you know, why not? Maybe Judas thought that. There's no indication in the text that that's what he thought. Other people think that maybe Judas was just really frustrated that Jesus has not become this king, this messianic powerhouse that he expected him to be. And so now Judas is going to like force his hand. He's going to put Jesus in a position where he's being arrested, and now Jesus has to show his glory and show his power. And again, that just seems like a total stretch to me, because there's nothing in the text that tells us that. In fact, the thing that the text seems to be focusing on is the fact that Judas was greedy. He kept the money box, and he stole from the money box. He criticized Mary for offering the 300 denarii worth of ointment because really he was just a greedy person. And I think that at the end of the day, it was greed that caused him to betray Jesus. I mean, 30 days' wages, I mean, that's a good amount of money, you know? That's several thousand dollars. And for Judas, that was enough. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 10 tells us the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. James 3 in verse 16 says, "For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice." Greed is just the product of selfishness and worldliness. And greed can lead us to do some really terrible things. You've probably known people who have mistreated others, destroyed relationships, destroyed careers, destroyed their lives, destroyed their families because of greed. And so it would do us well to beware of greed, because greed is what led Jesus to betray the Son of God. Well, now in verse 12, it tells us that on the first day of unleavened bread, when they sacrificed the Passover lamb, his disciples said to him, "Where will you have us go and prepare for you to eat the Passover?" And he sent two of his disciples and said to them, "Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him. And wherever he enters, say to the master of the house, 'The teacher says, where is my guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' And he will show you a large upper room furnished and ready. There, prepare for us." And the disciples set out and went to the city and found it just as he had told them, and they prepared the Passover. So verse 12 gives us another time marker. Now we're being told that it's on the first day of unleavened bread when they sacrificed the Passover lamb. And that would be a reference to Thursday, when preparations are made on Thursday to eat the Passover meal at sundown. And the directions that Jesus gives to his disciples are very similar to the directions that he gave in chapter 11. Remember, as he was preparing for that triumphal entry and he told them, you know, go into the city or the town and you'll find this colt and you can make arrangements for that. And just as we discussed then, I don't think that there's anything really supernatural happening as far as the arrangements. Apparently, either Jesus made these arrangements ahead of time, or he knows that the people are very supportive. And so when you ask somebody to do something in the name of the teacher, they're going to be eager to do that. But either way, it goes exactly the way Jesus said that it would. In verse 16, they find the man, they go to the city, they prepare the Passover feast in the upper room. Now, I want to take just a minute to think about the Passover. Because as I said at the beginning of this chapter, the Passover is an important backdrop for all of the events that are playing out at the end of the gospel narrative. And remember that the Passover was an annual feast that the Jews celebrated in remembrance of their exodus from Egypt. You can read about that in Exodus chapters 12 and 13. And in those chapters, you read that the 10th and final plague against Egypt was the death of the firstborn. And so what God told the Israelites to do was to slaughter a lamb and to take its blood, and with hyssop to smear the blood on the lintel and the doorpost of their house. And if they were to do that and eat the lamb, that the angel of death or the Lord would pass over them as he struck the nation of Israel with death. I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind, because when the Lord struck the Egyptians, the Israelites fled quickly. They took their dough before it was leavened. They ate unleavened bread on the way out. And God told those people to remember those events every year with the Passover feast and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. But it's very fitting that these events surround the Passover feast, because Jesus is in fact fulfilling what the Passover was all about. Just like Israel was enslaved to Pharaoh in Egypt, every one of us has been enslaved. Our evil tyrant is not Pharaoh, but the devil himself. we were not enslaved in Egypt, but in our sins. In fact, 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 7 says, Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. It's because of the blood of the lamb that the Lord's wrath passes over us. And I think that Jesus chose this time to make his sacrifice very intentionally. Because as his disciples are preparing the Passover for him, Jesus is actually preparing the greater Passover for all of them. It's appropriate that Jesus takes the Passover meal and makes it into something new with the Lord's Supper. And so as we keep reading, what we see is shortly the Lord's Supper, the institution of the Lord's Supper. But first there's this conversation that happens between him and his disciples. In verse 17, it says, And when it was evening, he came with the 12. And as they were reclining at table and eating, Jesus said, Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me. They began to be sorrowful and to say to him one after another, Is it I? He said to them, It is one of the 12, one who is dipping bread into the dish with me. For the Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born. So now they're eating the Passover at the traditional time, and Jesus drops what must have just been a bombshell on them. In verse 18, he says, One of you will betray me. One of the 12, one of the one who is eating with me will be my betrayer. Jesus is about to be betrayed by one of those who is closest to him. Jesus knows who it is. Judas certainly knows who it is. But apparently nobody else does. I find that really interesting. Do you remember when you were in school and there was like always that kid that always was the kid that got in trouble? And so if anybody in the class was going to mess up, everybody would know like who it would be that would mess up. You know, it's like, oh man, him again, right? You know, I think I've always had this idea that Judas kind of always was like a shady looking character, you know, just kind of seemed sketchy, like you couldn't really trust him. But when Jesus says, one of the 12 will betray me, you know what they don't do? They don't say, it's Judas, isn't it? I knew we couldn't trust that guy. But they say, is it me? Am I the one? I think that tells us a couple of things. First of all, I think it tells us that Judas was really, really good at being sneaky. And sometimes we can be. Sometimes we can fool our friends, we can fool our families, we can put on a good face. Jesus knows who we really are. But I think it also shows us a really good attitude in the disciples. You know, when you find out that somebody has done something shocking, something that's really terrible, sometimes we have the totally wrong reaction. You know, you find out that somebody has been embezzling a lot of money, or you find out that somebody has been in an affair. And a lot of times the way that we feel sometimes, especially if it's somebody that we thought we knew, that we thought we could trust, we would be like, wow, can you believe that? I thought I knew that person. How could they do that? I would never do such a thing. 1 Corinthians 10 in verse 13 says, Beware. Let him who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. The truth is, any one of us could do those terrible things. Given the right circumstances, given the right weaknesses, you know, every one of us is susceptible to failing. And I think that this is a really good example of humility. That Jesus' disciples, when they're confronted with this unthinkable, horrible thing that one of them is going to betray Jesus, they say, Is it me? Is it me? That's the kind of attitude that we have to have. That as we think about the sin and the temptation that surrounds us, that it shouldn't make us prideful, but it should make us humble. It should remind us that we can't ever put total confidence in anybody, even ourselves. It's only the Lord that we can trust. And if even one of Jesus' 12 closest disciples could betray him, we need to keep a very close watch on ourselves. Now, in this context, Jesus doesn't actually identify his betrayer. He says that it's one of the 12. And in John chapter 13, it reads a little bit differently, where he gives Judas a morsel of bread, and Judas knows that Jesus knows. But still, even in John 13, the rest of the disciples aren't sure who it is. And Judas just sort of makes his exit at this point. But notice the point that Jesus makes in verse 21. Jesus says, "For the Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed." It would have been better for that man if he had not been born. Jesus wants to make it clear that he has not lost control. That even as he is betrayed, even as he is arrested, even as he goes to his death, it's not that things are happening that surprise him. Things are going exactly the way that he's always known that they would go. But that doesn't excuse Judas for what he's doing. Even though God is taking Judas's sin and making it, using it for something wonderful and something glorious, it's still a terrible sin, and Judas is still guilty of it. And what a heartbreaking thing it would have been to hear those words. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born. But now we'll finish with these last few verses. It says that as they were eating, in verse 22, he took bread, and after blessing it, broke it and gave it to them, and said, "Take, this is my body." And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank of it. And he said to them, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. Truly I say to you, I will not drink again of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." So now we read where Mark tells us about Jesus instituting the Lord's Supper. He tells his disciples that the bread is his body and that the grape juice is his blood of the covenant. And clearly Jesus is not speaking metaphysically. It's not actually physically transforming, but he's using a very strong analogy. Metaphorically, this blood represents his body, or the bread represents his body and the juice represents his blood. And Jesus tells his disciples that he won't drink it again until he drinks it new in the kingdom of God. Jesus is anticipating a time when he would commune with his disciples in a new covenant. And we might have lots of questions about what that's about. What is it that Jesus is referring to? When is Jesus going to drink it new in the kingdom of God? Well, look over in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. I want you to see what the Apostle Paul wrote about the Lord's Supper here. In verse 16, he says, "The cup of blessing that we bless, is it not a participation in the blood of Christ? The bread that we break, is it not a participation in the body of Christ? Because there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread." What Paul is describing is that when we partake of the Lord's Supper, that we are having communion with all believers everywhere. But not only are we having communion with all believers, we're having communion with the Lord himself. He is an honored guest, you might say. And so that's why sometimes we call the Lord's Supper communion, because we're having communion not only with each other, but also with Christ, just like he said one day we would. And what Paul goes on to tell us in 1 Corinthians 11 is that God wanted his people to remember this meal regularly, just like he wanted his people to remember the Passover regularly. In 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 26, it says, "For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." Now, I want you to think about this meal and its context. There's obviously a lot of different things that we could say about the Lord's Supper, but I want you to think about why it is here in Mark 14. We have first of all, we have Mary sacrificing 300 denarii for Jesus. We have Judas sacrificing Jesus for 30 denarii. And now we have Jesus sacrificing his own life for many. There's a good example, a bad example, and the ultimate example. And what Jesus has been showing us all along is that his kingdom is an upside-down kingdom. That greatness doesn't come from just beating other people down, but greatness is found in service. Jesus is showing us the glory of his self-sacrifice. And because Jesus is worth whatever we sacrifice to him, then because Jesus' own sacrifice is infinitely valuable, Jesus is worth whatever we sacrifice to him. That's the difference between those who honor Jesus and those who betray him. When we recognize the value of Jesus, we'll be happy to sacrifice all that we have to honor him. But if we fail to recognize the value of Jesus, we'll be quick to betray him for whatever we might be able to get. And so that's what I want you to think about as we finish this section this afternoon. Do you appreciate the value of Jesus' sacrifice? Do you see the beauty? Do you see the glory? Do you see the wonder in the Son of God giving his life for you? Do you appreciate that? How much would it take for you to betray him? What amount of money or pleasure or satisfaction would be worth turning your back on him? Or how much are you willing to give to honor him? What amount of money, what amount of time, what amount of effort, what amount of enthusiasm is he worth to you? The truth is, the Son of God gave his life as a ransom for you. And now he's asking you to give your life to him. If there's anybody here this afternoon that needs to make your life right with God, I ask that you take this time as we sing this song to think about Jesus' sacrifice. Meditate on that. And if you need to make your life right with God, you can come to the front and let us know while we stand and sing.